Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the McGill International Review. Today, I'm talking with David French, a columnist for the New York Times that I had on the podcast a few months ago. And we talk about quite a bit of subjects this time, but I guess the one tether that we used to tie all of it together this time around was gender. For example, we spend a lot of the beginning of the conversation talking about the ways that the young men and young women of my generation are drifting apart ideologically and politically. And we also talk a little bit about the decline of participation in things like church and the way that church has traditionally upheld certain norms about gender. And we also talk quite a bit about how important certain differences between men and women are, where they might be understated, where they might be overstated, stuff like that. So yeah, hope you enjoy. David French, thank you so much for taking the time to come onto the podcast.
Very happy to do it.
Yeah, so I guess my first question right off the bat, just to set a scene and introduce us to one important facet of some of what we're going to be talking about. Could you talk a little bit about gender polarization?
Yeah, so there's always been a gender gap in American politics, or at least, you know, since the modern era. I'm not going to certify what the gender gap was in 1936, but in the modern era, we've had a pretty meaningful gender gap with Republicans, men leaning more Republican, women leaning more Democratic. But in recent years, we've seen that gender gap really expand, especially in young people, with some indications that young men are becoming more conservative, but a ton of indications that young women, teen girls in particular, are becoming far more progressive. And so you're beginning to get a big, much bigger gap between the sexes when it comes to politics. And there are a million potential reasons for this, but one of the reasons is, quite frankly, men and women in many ways are spending less time together. Men are spending a lot more time in some more men-only spaces, such as, or mainly male spaces like gaming. Young girls are much more likely to be spending the time, say, on Instagram than Call of Duty. And we're even beginning to see less dating, less time hanging out with each other, delayed marriage. And so a lot of the forces that kind of pulled men and women together over the last many, many generations, a lot of those forces are dissipating. And instead, we're having a lot of cultural forces that are separating out men and women more, which is kind of ironic when you think about it, because we live in an era of formalized legal prohibitions against gender discrimination, for example. But culturally, there are signs that men and women are just not forming relationships in the way that they used to. And so that is going to create separate communities, separate cultures, and sort of exacerbate a lot of those differences.
Yeah, so you mentioned that men and women are spending much less time together. They're retreating to stuff like video games or social media. So I guess one question I have as a result of that would be, to what extent do you think our increasing secularization and the decline of participation in in-person religious institutions is playing a role in the gender divide of my generation?
Yeah, everything that is the decline of in-person engagement is part of this. So whether it is decline of religious attendance, whether it is less time kids spend hanging out together, which is, you know, where I am in the South in the United States, we have lots of church youth groups and things like that that put boys and girls together, right? Well, if there's no church youth group, and if you play on a women's volleyball team, for example, and you're not in, and you're doing travel volleyball where you're just around all your teammates all the time, there's just a lot less time that exists to hang out with people. And it's really fascinating to look at the declining prevalence of physical time that people spend together. And church is a place where that kind of physical presence and that creation of a physical community was it's a centerpiece of the whole experience. And so, yeah, declining church attendance means declining physical presence in many ways with other people.
Yeah, so I think my generation's decline in the participation of in-person religious institutions like church is something that I think is one of the most interesting and important phenomenons of our current day society. So I guess my next question is, could you talk a little bit about what you would find to be some of the main causes of people retreating and like some of the main causes of the decline of the participation in religious institutions in the present day?
Yeah. So, boy, that's a big and complex issue. And there's a couple of really tremendous books that have come out in the last couple of years that have tried to explain this. And as with any complex social phenomenon, you really don't have a monocausal explanation. There's sort of like no one thing that's leading to this, but there are several things that are leading to this. So a lot of people will say, for example, scandals in the church are a leading reason why people are leaving church, that church abuse, sexual harassment, sexual abuse, spiritual abuse, you name it. And that is a factor. It's a big factor, but it is not the biggest factor if you start to look at it in toto. But it is a big factor that churches have mistreated a sufficient number of people so dramatically, and then kind of compounded the mistreatment with things like non-disclosure agreements, by cover-ups, by lies, that there's just a big community of people out there who've been treated horribly in church, and they have voices and they share their experiences, and their friends and family have seen their experiences, and has a huge negative effect. But that's one piece of the puzzle. It's not the biggest piece of the puzzle, but it's very meaningful. Another piece of the puzzle is simply what we're finding is that when people have competing choices to make, they're consistently choosing not to go to church. So if youth sports, for example, conflicts with church, families by and large are choosing youth sports. Another factor that is leading to less church attendance is when people move. When they move, they're often not prioritizing finding another church. And so they immediately begin to get into a routine in their new place that doesn't include church. Here's another factor that is really interesting. And this was articulated in a book a couple of years ago. The end of the Cold War is very... The decline in religious attendance really correlates with the end of the Cold War. And one of the interesting theories behind it was that during the Cold War, religious identity and national identity were much more closely connected, because the Soviet Union was an atheistic communist empire, explicitly atheistic. And so the contrast is that we were not atheistic. We were a Christian, and then we were capitalist and democratic. They were atheistic and communist and authoritarian. And so that religious identity was really set up in opposition to the atheism of the Soviet Union. And so that people were wrapping their religious identity into the national identity. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, that wasn't so necessary anymore. So sort of the natural agnosticism of an awful lot of people emerged. So there's just a lot of reasons for it. I haven't hit on all of them, but those are some of the big reasons why we've just seen a considerable decline in church attendance and church and religious affiliation.
Yeah. So I guess what would you consider to be some of the negative sociological effects that the decline of in-person institutions like church has had on the men and women in my generation?
Well, one thing is just that decline in in-person physical community. This is something that is a massive problem in American society in particular. We just have less what you would call, we have fewer embodied relationships. We have fewer friendships. So, for example, you know, the number of percentage of men who report having no friendships at all, no close friendships at all, has skyrocketed. And the number or percentage of men who report having many friends has really diminished. And so there are sociological, sort of positive sociological effects of going to church that when you remove yourself from that community, you don't have. But the problem is that to tell someone go to church because of positive sociological effects is really unpersuasive. It is not persuasive, because the root of church is religious devotion. And so if you're going to church just to hang out with people, you're missing it. And so what I would say is that the church attendance decline is inextricably related to the decline in belief that then has sociological effects that we can measure. But to say, go back to church for the sociological effects is the wrong message. The message that churches should be sending is, we want you to hear because what we say, what we believe about Jesus is true. That's that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. And same with if you are talking about people who are not going to religious observances and other traditions, that you're not calling them back to those traditions by saying, oh, look, there's a 17% chance, 17% lower rate of anxiety and depression. Like, that's not what does it. It is, you know, if you're Muslim, the truth claims in the Quran. If you're Jewish, you know, the truth claims of the Jewish religious tradition. Same with Christians, that you are calling people back to something that you believe in from the bottom of your heart to be true. That's what is the important thing, not the sociological positive side effects of these embodied communities.
Yeah, so I guess one aspect of your answer that I thought was kind of interesting that I want to narrow in on a little bit was the facet where you talked about how men have significantly fewer friendships in the present day. So would you be down to talk a little bit about the struggles that men and boys face in modern society? Because I mentioned this before, but I do think that the issues that men and boys face in modern society are some of the most important and undercovered issues in society right now. So yeah, could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, we're seeing a real increase in men who, well, let me put it this way. Men are just falling behind. And in many ways, this is invisible to a lot of people because at the tip of the spear, sort of the apex of power, corporately, militarily, in entertainment and education, men are doing great. You know, men are still disproportionately in the boardrooms and disproportionately in the C-suites and disproportionately general officers and all of this stuff. At the very top level of society, men are doing just fine, that elite. But if you move beyond the elite, what you see is a huge issue. And it is at every new level of education, from high school to community college to graduate school, men fall behind women and men are falling behind women. Colleges are becoming disproportionately female. If you look at things like suicides, if you look at things like deaths of despair, violence, of course, has always been disproportionately male, but a lot of markers of mental distress are falling hard on men. Now, teenage girls have their own special extreme levels of anxiety and depression. So no one should say like all the girls are just fine, but we're beginning to see men falling behind at every stage. We're beginning to see, you see extraordinary rates of deaths of despair among single men, whether they are never married or divorced. And it's just at this point, finally, people have realized like there is an issue with men in this society. And it's taken some time for people to get there because they've long sort of focused on women being second-class citizens and lifting men up, or women up. But now a lot of people are realizing that men have a real issue in this country.
Yeah, so I guess on the topic of like the whole thing about masculinity and men and the way that they have a problem in society right now.
Yeah.
So you made what I thought was a pretty memorable guest appearance on Sean Eiling's podcast a few years ago, where you said something, you talked about how in the past you were known quite well for your critiques of the left and the way that they portrayed masculinity. But like in recent years, ever since the turn of the Trump era, you've been a lot more vocal towards the right for the way that they treat manhood and masculinity. So I think that's, could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so yeah, it's pretty easy to explain. So if you're going back to the pre-Trump era and early Trump era, then what you would find is that a lot of the conversation about masculinity was from the left against sort of traditional masculinity. And in fact, it was what the American Psychological Association who put out a big study slash, you know, a policy paper saying traditional masculinity ideology is on the net harmful for men. And I really dove into this, and I began to realize that what was happening was that in many ways, people on the left were taking common male characteristics, such as an adventurous spirit or a sort of a more aggressive personality or a person who's more drawn towards aggression, and you name it, and saying, essentially, all of these are problems to be solved. And so what that message sends to a lot of boys and young men is, there's something wrong with your very nature, that if you're feeling ambitious or if you are a risk taker, you have an inclination to be more aggressive, that there's something fundamentally wrong with that, as opposed to saying these are just disproportionately male characteristics that can be virtuous or not depending on how they're shaped. And so if you're sending a message to young men that there's something wrong with your very nature, you're really demoralizing them. But if you say, hey, here's your fundamental nature, and those aspects of you can be really good if they're shaped in the right way. So like, take aggression. Even aggression is something that a lot of people would say, well, aggression's bad. Well, you need a level of aggression in a Marine. You need one. You need a level of aggression. So a Marine would be an example of someone whose sense of aggression has been shaped towards virtuous ends. And then the person for whose sense of aggression is left to it, where he's left to his own devices and his own sort of moral sense and goes astray, is, you know, a violent criminal. A violent criminal is somebody whose sense of aggression was never shaped and only led to a devolution. And so on the left, what I was seeing was a lot of people saying, hey, all of these stereotypical characteristics of boys, they're all bad. Where I'm saying they're just characteristics and they can be good or bad depending on how you shape them. And then, so I'm having this argument with the left and then the rise of Trump and the Trump era, and all of a sudden the right stops defending what I would call virtuous masculinity and starts indulging in the worst and most toxic forms. So what the right and the Trump era basically said is, oh, all of that stuff like aggression and all of that, let's just indulge it. Let's just absolutely pour ourselves into aggression. And rather than saying, well, let's shape it to virtuous ends, teach restraint, it became, you know what, you, dear left, have a stereotype of toxic masculinity. Well, we're going to live that stereotype. We're going to glory in it. And Andrew, you know what it reminded me of? It's like when the right was critiquing mainstream media, going back in the late 80s, early 90s, going, this mainstream media is totally biased. We have to do something about this. We need to create alternative institutions to compete with the mainstream media. And so they said, mainstream media is bad. And then all of a sudden it turns into, let's make something worse than mainstream media. And much of that is the same on the right in the masculinity conversation. It's the left's vision of masculinity is bad. We're going to counter it with something even worse. And that's how that's a very long answer to your very short question.
Yeah. So I guess obviously there's the whole thing about how you used to be a lot more vocal about the way that the left would view men and masculinity, and now you've rightfully turned your gaze towards the right because of people like Donald Trump, who are obviously abhorrent, in a lot of ways. But I guess my question now is, like, have your feelings on the left changed with regards to the way that the left sees masculinity? Do you think that they've gotten better, or do you think it's just the sort of thing where the left is bad at this and the right is bad at this, and like both the left and right are bad at understanding healthy masculinity in their own ways?
I think what I've seen on the left is a greater recognition that men are in crisis. Whereas I think, you know, even going back 6, 7, 8 years, that on the left, there was just sort of the sense that, you know, men are the winners, like in the sort of oppressed oppressor category. Men are historically powerful relative to women. Men have all of the advantages relative to women, that the real focus, to the extent that we're going to focus on lifting anyone up on the basis of sex or gender, it's going to be women. And so there was a lot of there were a lot of people who were very reluctant to hear the message that, no, actually, except at that tip of the spear, except at the elite, just tons and tons of regular, everyday, ordinary men, boys and men, are really struggling. And there was this reluctance to hear that, I think. And now people have fully come on board to, oh, crap, men are really struggling. Young men are really struggling in some important ways. And so I've actually seen more openness to creative solutions. On the right, I feel like a lot of the battle is over, well, how much should we look at Donald Trump, Tucker Carlson, Jordan Peterson, Andrew Tate? And now they're all different. Andrew Tate and Jordan Peterson are not the same. But there's this Joe Rogan, there's this real sort of guru mentality, like who's the archetype of the man that I want to be? And not all of them are virtuous. Not all of them are worth emulating at all. Like Andrew Tate is horrific. Donald Trump is horrific. I have much more different feelings about Jordan Peterson, say. I think there are good things about him and bad things about him. But there's this real guru mentality you're seeing rise up on the right, where there are these toxic, terrible people. And when I think of the main ones, I think of Andrew Tate or Donald Trump, for example, who are putting forth an extremely exploitive and cruel version of what it looks like to be a man. That they're essentially they're the archetype of the bully. And that is not the traditional view of manhood on the right. The traditional view is much more embodied by this moment in the movie American Sniper, where Chris Kyle's dad talks about sheep, sheepdogs, and wolves. And he says, you know, there are sheep who are essentially kind of powerless in the face of oppression. And he says, I'm not raising sheep. And he said, there are wolves, and the wolves live to exploit and oppress the sheep. And he said, I'm not raising a wolf, but the sheepdog protects the sheep, and that's who I'm raising. And that was always kind of this construct, like you would hear it in, you know, moms of conservative moms, I'm raising sheepdogs. And then all of a sudden, everyone starts loving the wolves. They start loving the Trump, the Andrew Tate, they start loving the wolves. And so all of a sudden, the masculinity construct on the right becomes much more focused on creating wolves.
Yeah, so I guess I want to pivot a little bit back to, I think we talked a little bit about some of the ways in which men are struggling, like they're retreating from a lot of in-person institutions, they have a lot less friendships, and like they're also attending church far less often than they used to. So I guess one question that I have as a result of that is that when it comes to church and like religious institutions, to what extent do you think they have failed and or are like continuing to fail boys and men that are struggling in the present day?
Oh, there's no question that churches have been failing boys. And part of it is that people have not, let me put it this way. So having been deeply involved for like 25, 30 years and sort of evangelical men's ministries and things like this, there's been a large scale recognition of a problem, a prescription of a solution that doesn't really work, and then kind of a lack of understanding about how men form relationships. So let me kind of walk through this. So the church has had this view that is very much, has for a long time been very focused on masculinity. But it has dealt with masculinity in some of the wrong ways, because what it's essentially tried to do is say to a lot of men, okay, we're going to adopt what sort of the world defines as a good man, and we're going to Christianize it a little bit. And so, you know, there's a big emphasis in Christian circles and men's ministries of, you can be a guy, you can be a manly man and still a Christian too. You know, so you'll have the monster truck rally at a Christian conference, and you'll have, you know, one Bible study, I was a men's Bible studies a part of, was like, let's go to the gun range for our Bible study, you know? And so a lot of it is sort of whatever is stereotypical, like manly man stuff to do, you can still do that and be a Christian, is the argument. But then what ends up happening is the emphasis becomes more on the manly man part of it and less on the following Jesus part of it. And so you have a lot of these Christian men's ministries that are really just sort of trying to Christianize, throw a little, like how you put croutons on a salad. They're sort of putting Christ croutons on the salad of the general cultural view of what a man is supposed to be. And so that is not adequate. That is not adequate. And so I think one of the issues is we don't actually drill down as much and talk about things less from the standpoint of here's what it's like to be a man, to here's what it's like to be a good person. Here's what it's like to be a good person. And then because you're a man, that's going to manifest itself in different ways, in some different ways. And so there needs to be, I think, recircling back on what does it mean to be a good human being, just a good person. Because then when you're laying on top of that, well, you also have to be a good man, whatever that means. Then you're laying on top of people some extra biblical or extra things that are outside of Christianity, social, sort of sociological norms and mores. When the reality is, Scripture doesn't spend a lot of time saying, this is what it's like to be a good man versus this is what it's like to be a good woman. There's some of that, but most of it is, this is what it's like to be a good person. You know, so for example, what are the fruit of the Spirit? Kindness, peace, patience, gentleness, joy, self-control, etc. That's for all of us, men or women. And those are our cardinal virtues you're supposed to exhibit. And so I feel like what we've done is we've often given people an extra sense of anxiety that says, I'm not just supposed to be a good person, I'm supposed to be a good man. And the man part of it is the extra layer. It's I need to have some firearms. I need to be able to, you know, start a fire on my own. I need to, you know, whatever the extra thing is that's being larded on top of it. Not that those things are bad, but it's the extra stuff larded on top of it that is putting this sort of burden on guys that says being a good person is not enough. And I think that that's a mistake. I think that's a mistake.
Yeah, so I think one part of your answer that I found really interesting was the whole thing about how what churches should be doing is they should be trying to teach people how to be a good person, and like that would manifest itself differently, like if you're a man or like a woman. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, so let's take for example, what does a good person, you know, one way being a good person manifests itself is caring for people who are vulnerable or caring for people who are in distress. And so let's say your ethos is I'm somebody who's caring for someone in distress, and person A is a 6'3", 235-pound man who can bench press 275, which is a lot. And person B is a 5'2", 125-pound woman who might have all of the courage in the world but just lacks certain like physical capabilities. Person A might say, well, to help others, I'm drawn to things that A, help others, and B, take advantage of my physical gifts, you know? And so that's how something like that will work out, is I'm drawn to help others because the focus of my life has been driven by selflessness, sacrifice, etc. And that will manifest itself differently with somebody who has certain kinds of physical gifts, for example, or intellectual or emotional gifts, in different ways. And because men and women are constructed from a chromosomal level up very differently. I mean, we have a different kinds of chemical cocktails running in our brains. We have different kinds of physiques and physiological structures. We're going to be different. And so virtues will manifest themselves in different ways, but it's still the same virtue.
Yeah, so I guess the whole thing about how like male and female virtues might like manifest themselves differently because of differences between men and women, but they're still the same virtue. So I guess that makes me kind of interested, like, when it comes to, like differences between men and women, which institutions do you think are insufficiently cognizant of the biological differences between men and women? And, like, which institutions do you think are too cognizant of those differences?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think churches are often too cognizant of biological differences and imply too much from those biological differences. I think there's a way in which much of the church is sort of trying to reconstitute a patriarchy in a very negative sense. You know, you will see terms like complementarianism or hyper-complementarianism. It's, in one level, complementarianism can be, in many ways, quite benign and virtuous in the sense it says that men and women are different and have different roles of equal value. Okay, that's an argument worth having, okay? But often complementarianism devolves into men are in control of women and men are superior to women in some very concrete ways. And so that therefore the way in which society should be constructed is male dominant society, from not just in the church, but writ large. You know, for example, there's a famous pastor who has cast doubt on whether women could even be police officers because it's somehow unnatural for a woman to give a man commands. And so that is a arena of church that really is saying men and women are different. And oh, by the way, men should be in charge across the board. And that's extremely, I think there's so much about that is dark and dangerous. But I will say there are other institutions that are underappreciating differences. And, you know, for example, when you see the whole fight about trans participation in sports, the sex difference between men and women absolutely matters at high levels of athletic competition. It absolutely matters. And so to sort of say that it doesn't is to just, in many ways, deny reality, that these sex distinctions do translate into physical differences. And to deny that is to deny reality. So, that sort of the radical elements of gender theory that would say that sex and gender are these completely disconnected concepts, that gender is sort of actually the overriding sort of identity marker of your life more than sex. Some of these, you know, these notions that essentially the very definition of male and female are more malleable than we think. All of those things, I think, all of those ideas kind of really do serve to minimize very real differences, very real sex differences between men and women.
Yeah, so I guess the question is, like, what now? Like, what would you recommend for these different institutions about, like, what types of messaging you would prefer that they use when it comes to topics like masculinity and femininity?
Yeah, no, I think the what now question mark, you know, what now given all of this, what is the solution? And I think part of the solution really rests in not overthinking it as much as we do. That if we double back down on our goal as a culture, as a society, is to train young boys and girls to be good people, not just good men, not just good women, but good people. And there are a ton of common virtues in what it means to be a good person. And then at the same time, recognizing people as individuals, and that both as individuals, what it means to be a good person will be different person by person, dovetailing with their unique strengths and gifts. And then recognizing that men and women as a group are often going to have different strengths and gifts. Not every individual. There are women who are very physically strong and men who are not as strong. But as a whole, there are group differences, and that will manifest itself in some cultural differences between men and women, and that's okay. That's okay. We don't need to make men and women exactly the same, and we don't conversely need to make men hyper-masculine and women hyper-feminine. It is there are going to be group differences, and that's okay, but our ultimate emphasis is on raising a generation of good people. Raising a generation of good people. That overemphasis on masculinity and femininity, I feel like, is kind of driving people nuts.
So I guess my next question then is, like, what specific cultural messages do you think institutions should provide about things like masculinity and femininity in the present?
Well, it depends on the institution. So if I work for a bank, I don't think it should be telling me much one way or the other. If I'm part of a church, then I think there's a lot for it to say, or an educational institution. I think there is a lot for it to say. And I think institutions need to be very cognizant of when people are falling behind, and then talking to the people who are falling behind and trying to figure out why there is a failure to thrive. What is it? What is it that is creating this failure to thrive? And it's going to be different in different places. But, you know, I keep circling back to this notion of providing people with meaning and purpose by building up and reinforcing universal virtues. Reinforcing universal virtues and then encouraging people to pursue those universal virtues in a way that dovetails with who they are, what their specific strengths and weaknesses are. And the more that I see people doubling down on stereotypical views of what masculinity and femininity should be, the more dysfunctional we get.
Yeah, so I guess circling back to the beginning of our conversation, maybe it's the sort of thing where, like when we were talking about gender polarization and how, like, young men and young women, like the ones in my generation, are sort of drifting apart politically and ideologically, maybe a lot of that is the sort of thing where, like, social media and social media algorithms, they tend to exacerbate, like, certain cultural assumptions about inherent differences between men and women. And, like, they sort of treat them as, like, immutable characteristics rather than just, like, statistical occurrences and, like, statistical trends. Would you say that's correct?
Yeah. So, you know, so what social media does and what happens frequently in social media is that you have a situation where fads or trends pop up, and these fads or trends are then translated into the communicating to men and women, and they say, this is what it's like to be a guy. This is what it's like to be a woman. And then those fads and trends, there's nothing about them that are timeless or eternal. They're just fads or trends. And then you start to have people who feel like I'm not a real man if I'm not upholding this fad or trend, or I'm not, you know, in some ways manifesting what it means to be a good woman by upholding these fads or trends. And we have to be very careful about that. And that's why I often, when I think about what does it mean to be a good person, I'm going back to timeless virtues that are, they're not gendered, they're not uniquely rooted in sex, but they will manifest themselves in people's lives differently depending on who you are differently as an individual.
Yeah. But I guess I do want to push you on one thing, though, because, like, so, like, we've talked a little bit about how sometimes, for example, churches overstate biological differences between men and women, and, like, we should emphasize what it's like to be a good person and all of that. But so, like, circling back to the, like, earlier on in the conversation, you talked about how you've noticed that the left has started to become a little bit more cognizant of the struggles that men and boys face. So I guess what would you say to the idea that, like, in the past, when the left was insufficiently cognizant of the ways that men and boys are struggling? For example, let's look at, like, education. Boys are definitely falling behind in education. Would you say that, like, back then, maybe the response of the left would be to be, like, insufficiently cognizant of, like, biological differences of boys and, like, the fact that they tend to mature later on and, like, that sort of stuff, where, like, they would sort of pin it on, like, the nature versus nurture debate, where, like, boys are not, like, sufficiently raised well enough, or that, like, maybe it's, like, their fault for, like, falling behind in education because they're not, because we didn't train them to be, like, as well equipped to deal with things like school compared to girls. Like, what would you say to the idea that they would often invoke a sort of nature versus nurture debate when it comes to like men's struggles back then.
Yeah, you know, what I found on the left was not so much blaming men, but it was more denial. So it took a long time to convince people.
But maybe it's like the sort of thing where like it starts out as denial, but then like when you show them the statistics, it becomes more of like blaming them for their struggles.
Okay. It depends on who we're talking about. If we're talking about highly ideological people on the far left, who are really captured by this oppressor-oppressed mindset, victim-oppressor mindset, you saw a lot of, you would see blaming of men. You would see, well, men are struggling because they're not on top anymore and they're full of resentment, et cetera, et cetera. That wouldn't be the common response. Now, it might be the response you'd see if you only like look at libs of TikTok or something that is looking for the most extreme manifestation of opposing points of view and putting it out there. But what I much more saw was, wait, men are struggling? No. Men are not struggling. Men are on top. And men are on top because that's been such a message for a long time for good reason, because, you know, it's not that long ago women didn't have a right to vote. It's not that long ago that women had substantially inferior legal rights than men. And so what I saw was just this massive kind of disbelief that men were actually really struggling. And so, but once it kind of began to imprint, and I think one of the things that made it imprint is that lots of parents on the left saw their sons struggling and they said, what's going on? So it wasn't so much men are struggling and it's their fault because they're bad. It was men are not struggling. Here's more data. Men are not struggling. Here's more data. No, I think maybe they are. And then your own son struggles and you go, men are struggling. And so there's been a kind of an evolution in understanding, I would put it.
Yeah. So I guess, so like maybe it's the sort of thing where like Richard Reeves would often talk about how like boys are essentially square pegs being forced into round holes when it comes to the way that they're falling behind in educational settings. And I do believe that like is a big injustice in society, but maybe it's the sort of thing where like it's not the product of conscious choice and it's not the product of like actively blaming them or saying it's their fault. It's more that like there are a bunch of cumulative measures which over time have led to boys falling behind, and like we should still like ameliorate that, but it's not like out of a conscious decision or anything like that.
Well, I also, you know, I totally agree that things like much less recess has not been good for boys. Like there are some things that if you're talking about, again, where, yeah, there are a lot of super active girls who could really thrive with a lot more recess. But again, disproportionately, since men are more physical, the lack of recess has fallen upon them more disproportionately. I think things like that you need to take a close look at. Is it really better instruction if you have 8 hours in school and 7 hours and 45 minutes of that are instruction and 15 are recess versus when I was in school and it was 7 hours of instruction and 1 hour of recess? I mean, you really do need to look at things like that. And lack of male role models. I know Richard talks a lot about this, that there are professions like teaching, et cetera, nursing, others that are traditional service professions where you're only now beginning to see men entering these professions more. And so there's a lack of male role models. And so if you combine things like the loss of male role models in many homes with no male role models at school, you're going to begin to have you have big time mentoring problems. And so all of that is compounding. But I just think this narrative that you read on the right that is essentially like your local neighborhood school has been ideologically constructed by the left to squelch boys is just not correct. It's just not correct. It's a product of a lot of well-meaning reforms that have actually ending up hurting boys more than girls. But this sort of idea that school is constructed to squelch boys, I think it's been more like school has been constructed through a series of events over many years in a way that has had the effect of disproportionately harming boys, but was not the intent.
So are you making the case that when it comes to dealing with like a lot of gender inequities in society, especially the ones that are like more structural in nature, that like the best way to handle them is not by like having a very like gender conscious like decision making policy, but more like trying to use universal values that end up incidentally like easing those gender inequities.
I would put it like this: stop fighting human nature. Okay, so if you're in one sense, I believe we're all fallen and imperfect, and so we do need to be fighting against the fallen nature that we have. Absolutely, that's part of our mission to be good people, is to fight against that part of ourselves that's fallen and imperfect. But to the extent that we are sort of saying that here is a model for man, here is a model for women, and if that model is contradicting your nature, that you need to conform your nature to the model, you've got a problem. That's where your problem is. And so what the right does is now it's saying, here's what it means to be a man. It means basically being a giant asshole who spends a lot of time in the weight room. Is if that's your sort of vision of what it means to be a man, then you're taking an awful lot of people who A, should never behave like that, or have B, have no inclination to sort of be like that, and saying unless you're modeling a certain set of very aggressive values, you're not really a man. That's terrible. That's oppressive. And then if you're on the far left and you say to a guy who's got a lot of physical he's got a lot of aggression, he's very physically strong, he's very ambitious, that you shouldn't be like that, versus here's the way to shape these characteristics in a virtuous way. Those are two very different messages. And one of them is soul crushing and the other one is liberating. And so I think that's the distinction. How much are you telling somebody that their inherent intrinsic nature is bad for them? The way that they've been constructed is bad for them, and they have to be something totally different to be a good man or a good woman. That's where you start to get, I think, real trouble.
David French, thank you so much for taking the time to come back onto the podcast.
Yeah, happy to do it. Great conversation.
Thank you for listening. If you like the episode, make sure to follow us on Spotify, Podbean, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Until next time, goodbye.